Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 166, entitled, 6 Ways to Improve Your Energy, Physique, and Athletic Performance and Become a Much Healthier Man, I chat with Dr. Pankaj Vij. Dr. Vij is an internal medicine doctor, international speaker, and the author of the new book, Turbo Metabolism. In today's episode, Dr. Vij talks about how to improve your everyday health and wellness by following several concise but truly profound steps. He talks about the importance of optimizing your metabolism and how doing this can literally change your life in terms of physical performance, energy, and vitality, and how this can even reverse chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes. If you're wondering how to jumpstart your metabolism, rapidly improve your energy levels, function at your best each and every day, and even reverse many types of chronic sickness and disease, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. And now, a quick word from our fantastic sponsors. And by the way, all of our sponsors can be found in the show notes or at elitemanmagazine.com in the show's description, where you can click their links and check out the special offers they have for our Elite Man audience. The Elite Man Podcast is sponsored by HealthIQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/elite to support the show and see if you qualify. HealthIQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-minded individuals. You, being an Elite Man Podcast listener, are almost certainly among those health-conscious people. That's why you should really listen up. HealthIQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. So HealthIQ rewards you for being active and taking care of yourself. How cool is that? Look, you never know what's going to happen, especially if you're married, have children, or you've had personal scares or family members dealing with health issues. This is something you definitely cannot take lightly. It's so important to make sure your loved ones are kept safe no matter what, and HealthIQ helps you do that. It's the fastest growing life insurance company in the world with over $5 billion in coverage, and they're rated 9.6 out of 10 by Trustpilot. Do yourself and your family a huge favor and check out HealthIQ. To see if you qualify for an incredible savings of up to 33%, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/elite, or mention the promo code ELITE when you talk to a HealthIQ agent. Again, that's healthiq.com/elite. Are you hiring? Posting your position at job sites and waiting and waiting and waiting some more for the right people to see it? ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. No more waiting around forever. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/elite. That's ZipRecruiter.com/elite. And once more, ZipRecruiter.com/elite. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Dr. Pankaj Vij from DrVij.com. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Justin. I'm very, very excited about this conversation. I love your show. You've got lots of good information on it. I can't believe that you're interviewing me today.
I appreciate it. Very honored to have you on, and I appreciate the compliments for sure. I know you have a recent book that just came out, Turbo Metabolism, it's called, and essentially it's about how to improve your diet, amongst other things, lifestyle changes, and preventing, reversing diabetes, obesity, heart disease, and other metabolic diseases. We talk about the whole thing in the book. I want to dive into it in a couple of moments. But for those listeners who might not be as familiar with your backstory, can you just give us a minute or two of your background and, you know, your upbringing in the medical world and how you became the doctor you are today?
Yeah, it's been a fun journey for me. I am trained in conventional Western medicine, just like all your other MDs. I was born and raised in New Delhi, India, so I have a little bit of that Eastern background. And in 20 years of practice, there's a few things that I've learned, and one of the very big ones is that we don't harness the power of lifestyle quite enough, right? We jump straight to, hey, this is the best medicine for you. This blood pressure medicine isn't working. Let's put you on this other one. And before you know it, you're on 3, 4, 5 different pills. And, you know, the side effects of one are fighting with the good effect of the other. And we jump straight to those kinds of things, which we're trained very well in. But we don't think about really what we can do to optimize the conditions that maybe caused the problem in the first place. And over the last decade or so, my focus has shifted into really trying to understand the mechanisms of disease and the causes, and figuring out, hey, if we can know what the causes are, then we should be able to fix those, right? Instead of putting a Band-Aid solution, let's look at what's causing the issue. And, you know, if we get to the root cause of the problem, we can fix it once and for all.
Yeah, and I know you didn't. I asked you beforehand if you were a functional medicine doctor or a naturopathic doctor, and you said no, but it seems like you have the same principles, the philosophies of those types of people, and that you look at the body as a whole system, like everything working together, as opposed to, like you mentioned, you know, having a cut and just throwing a Band-Aid on it, or thinking of systems as different and separate organisms as opposed to working all at one, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can call it what you want. I mean, there's you know, specific certifications. You know, you could be ask somebody if they're a naturopathic doctor, there's actually a separate discipline where you can go to a naturopathic school and get a degree. It's called an ND. And the functional medicine folks, which is really an offshoot of really physicians, regular doctors who wanted to delve a little bit deeper and look at things more holistically. But I would say that anybody who's a good doctor is a holistic doctor, a functional doctor, someone that's taking into account all the different things that are in play. Rather than trying to have a reductionistic approach, they have an inclusive approach of looking at health and or looking at disease as much more than just this biological derangement, right? There's the psychosocial layers, the environmental aspects, looking at the disease or health of someone as a much more holistic phenomenon, rather than trying to break it down into, okay, your blood pressure is high, it's 150 over 90, here's some, you know, whatever, pills. You know, a machine can do that probably better than a human. So where humans come in, and where we can help each other, or where a doctor can move towards being a healer, is in understanding all the different layers that are going on in the life of that person, and really providing an individual solution rather than a cookie cutter cookbook solution. So it's that realization that we should be thinking of ourselves more like chefs than cooks, right? A cook follows a cookbook. A chef really uses his own creativity and his own mind to come up with an out-of-the-box, maybe a new solution or a new recipe or new way of looking at things, which someone that just follows a cookbook isn't going to.
What percentage of doctors out there do you think have the same philosophy as you? Do you think the majority of them don't? I mean, do you think there's anything wrong with the system of teaching in medical schools of, like, say, nutrition? I know that's very much a topic that gets overlooked in typical medical school. So what percentage of other doctors out there would you say actually have this same type of philosophy versus the prescription-first mentality that I think most doctors tend to have?
Well, I think it's more a matter of the system that we're caught up in. I mean, if you talk to, you know, a young person who's just going into medical school, or, you know, brand new medical students are in the first year, which I've had the joy of working with in some of the work that I've done teaching, you know, that curiosity, that creativity, that imagination, that out-of-the-box problem-solving approach, and the idealism of really making the world a better place is there when we start. But I think we get caught up. As everybody knows, healthcare is a mess in this country and much of the rest of the world too, wherever it's become sort of commercialized and it's a profit-making operation. And so that some of that idealism gets lost in time constraints and, you know, you've got 10 minutes and what are you going to do? It's a lot easier to write a prescription and move on to the next person in, you know, in less than 10 minutes that I have for this visit than it is to really delve into, you know, what they ate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the last week and how they're sleeping and how their relationship with their spouse is and what's going on with their teenage children and, you know, how is their boss treating them and what are they smoking and drinking and how much exercise are they getting and all these things are, you know, take a lot more time and a lot more energy. But I think at the core, if I would say 100% of doctors that if time wasn't an issue and if money wasn't an issue and they said in an ideal job, you know, what would give you most satisfaction? I think most people would say that I want to spend an hour with every patient and I want to get to know them better and I want to have them leave my office knowing that I've made a difference in their life. But the reality is that, you know, they might be stuck in a system where, you know, unfortunately they're moving people on this fast conveyor belt, this assembly line, and trust me, Justin, when it's unsatisfying for you, right, as a patient, when you have an unsatisfying visit with the doctor had an unsatisfying visit, unsatisfactory experience too. So they're going to be a lot more satisfied, a lot happier, a lot more fulfilled when you're happy and fulfilled and you feel like they made a difference. So So it's not from lack of motivation or lack of the right intentions. It's probably, to a large extent, it's, you know, being caught in this system too.
Yeah, no, I think that's dead on. I think you're 100% accurate. And most doctors I know are great people, and I think they get into the profession for the right reasons, as you said. But just the wear and tear of the years and the way the system is built, it just kind of breaks down their will and their desire. Not only not care for patients, because they always want to care for patients, but I think take the time that it takes to really get in there and figure out some of the core issues of a lot of the diseases and sickness they see. But again, I think that's their fault a lot of the time. Like you said, 10 minutes is not nearly enough to really assess a patient's, you know, full scope of their health and their activity and lifestyle, et cetera. What is it about you that you've been able to buck that trend and actually take the time it takes to really dive in there and learn and figure out what's the root cause of a lot of these issues and actually help your patients like more than most doctors would?
Well, a lot of us now are looking at other ways of novel ways of, you know, how do we work within the system while, you know, still trying to do something a little bit different. And there's a lot of newer experiments that are being tried. I, for one, do a lot of group appointments where I'll talk to a group of people, right? If there's 15 people in a group, now I can spend more time with them. And they all need to hear more or less the same thing, so we can do it as a group and have a discussion with them. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, do it in a way where I'm doing public speaking. I'm speaking to a group of people here and there and give them a chance to ask questions. Or, you know, I'm setting up a website. I'm putting videos online. Or even writing this book was partly my own need, right? Because I was finding that I didn't have the time to tell you everything that I needed to tell you and the constraints that I'm working with. So, you know, here I'm going to put down everything that I feel like I need you to know. And it's here in this book and you can go read it in your own time. And then next time I see you, you know, we can have a much more fruitful conversation. If you're motivated to go ahead and learn that information and take that extra step and, you know, a lot of people are looking for that information. Many aren't. Many aren't, too. And then they'll be happy to, hey, I don't want to change what I'm eating. Just give me a pill so I can go ahead and stop, you know, at the fast food joint on my way home and pick up cheeseburger and fries and a milkshake. And just give me a pill that will take my cholesterol down so that that food doesn't affect me. Well, guess what? It doesn't work like that, right? It is more work on both ends to really get to the root cause and treat it. But when we do take that approach, it's so much more satisfying. It's you're gonna really truly have made a difference and change the trajectory of somebody's life.
Cool, man. I like it. So diving into your book, Turbo Metabolism, how did you come up with that title? What does that mean exactly? And why did you go with the metabolism of all things to invoke your message?
Well, I think metabolism is a word that I hear several times every day because I work with people with these chronic diseases, with obesity, overweight, heart problems, diabetes, you know, all these metabolic diseases, trying to work with people to help them lose weight and get more healthy. And, you know, the one thing that I would hear back over and over again was, there's something wrong with my metabolism. There's something broken with my metabolism. And so I said, okay, Lev, what is this thing? What is metabolism? And a lot of people, when you ask them, aren't really able to answer the question. So I said, what is this mysterious thing that everybody's talking about that nobody knows what it really means? And when you really think about it, metabolism is life. Anything that has life has metabolism, because metabolism is the flow of that energy through a living being, right? And I had a nice big lunch and I'm sitting here talking to you, and if God forbid for whatever reason I said one, all of a sudden I dropped dead right this second, my metabolism would stop, right? Mm-hmm. So all that food that I just put in my stomach that's being metabolized, digested, converted into energy in my digestive system, all of a sudden would stop digesting and it would start rotting in my stomach and my intestines. So the lack of metabolism is death. The presence of metabolism is life. And that the energy transactions, right, the conversion of that food into energy is essentially metabolism. So then I started thinking about, okay, so what is that made up of? What makes up someone's metabolism? And what can we do to make sure that that metabolism is working in its optimal state? But essentially what that would mean is that all the fuel that you're taking in is being converted into energy, and Pankaj or Justin or whoever it is has lots of energy to do all the things that they like to do, to go mountain biking, to go hiking, to lift weights at the gym, to ride their bike, to have sex, to climb Mount Everest, and feel good about it and have a good quality of life. That's, in essence, that's turbo metabolism.
Cool. And by turbo charging your metabolism, are you able to, say, reverse some of these diseases that we talked about earlier, the diabetes, obesity, the metabolic diseases related to that as well, heart disease, those things? Are you able to do that once you fix the issues with your metabolism?
Absolutely. So what I'm purporting to say is that all these diseases are manifested by the metabolism not working properly, i.e. the energy delivery system is broken, right? I'm putting gas in the gas tank. Somehow it's not making its way to the engine to be converted into power for my car to move forward. And instead, my engine is sputtering and, you know, fumes are coming out and my car isn't, you know, very powerfully going forward. It's kind of sluggishly sputtering along the highway, while everybody else whose cars have good metabolism are flying by, right? So essentially, so you think about, we'll just do one example. You think about someone who has diabetes. And so a new patient with undiagnosed diabetes will come in complaining that they feel tired, they feel sluggish, right? Their muscles don't have any strength. They're very hungry, so they're eating a lot of food, but they're also peeing a lot. They're urinating a lot because their blood sugars are high. But other than the hunger and the peeing, the main symptoms are all related to fatigue and malaise and being tired and having no energy and having, you know, being foggy headed, I can't think clearly. So essentially they're taking in all that food, but it's not fueling their body very well. Why? Because that fuel isn't making its way into the cells. The glucose, which is the energy currency, isn't making its way into the muscles, into their heart, into their brain, right? And instead it's collecting somewhere. Where is it collecting? It's actually collecting in the bloodstream. So they have high glucose, they have high blood sugar in the bloodstream, But inside their muscles, they have low blood sugar because that sugar isn't making its way to where it needs to go, which is into the cells. So essentially, that's impaired energy flow or impaired movement of, in this case, glucose, which is the fuel, right? Mm-hmm. And if we can fix that impairment, we can open up the passages. It would be like putting some STP in your gas tank that goes and cleans up all the clogged valves and everything. And now my engine's getting that high octane fuel, and it's going right into the every single valve into my engine, and it's rearing forward like a twin turbo.
And so in the book, do you talk about the specific ways to do this, to repair your insulin resistance and fix the diabetes? Is there specifics for this, or is it like a general overall, like, I know there's six steps. I want to cover these six steps in a few minutes, but I know there's a general overall consensus of being happier, of turbocharging your metabolism. Is that the same protocol for a vast number of conditions, or is there specific ways to, like, say, do improve diabetes versus heart disease and some of the others?
See, that's the fascinating thing, right, Justin? We were talking about being holistic in our approach, and it turns out that we have artificially created all these definitions. You know, we say, okay, this is type 2 diabetes, and this other person has obesity, and this other person has a high blood pressure, and this fourth person has cardiovascular disease or coronary artery disease, and this fifth person is Alzheimer's. And as you go a little bit deeper into it, you realize that, oh my gosh, these guys all have the same disease, or it's the same mechanism for all these diseases. So we've created all these different names, but the process at the cellular level is the same thing that's going on. It's essentially not getting enough energy. It's not having proper metabolism. So if you're not getting enough glucose into the muscles because the muscles are blocked by fat, we call that intramyocellular fat, or, you know, just because doctors like to use fancy words, we went to so many years of school and we want people to think that we're really smart, so we use long words. But when the muscles are being blocked by fat, the muscle cells aren't able to receive that fuel, and that is type 2 diabetes. If your brain cells weren't receiving energy, right, the brain cells will start to atrophy, they would start to die off, not function properly. It turns out that that is now believed to be the mechanism for Alzheimer's. And there are a lot of very respectable researchers that are classifying Alzheimer's as possibly type 3 diabetes. So we know about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Well, type 3 diabetes or diabetes of the brain might be what we call Alzheimer's dementia, which is the 80% of dementia, memory loss in the elderly is Alzheimer's. And if you're not getting enough blood flow to the muscles of the heart, what happens to them? They die off. We call it ischemia. Or if they have some loss of muscle, we call it an infarction or heart attack. So that's loss of energy delivery, loss of blood flow to the heart. So if there's lack of energy delivery to the blood vessels, or the fat is accumulating. So the fat could be the soot in the engine valves, right? So instead of being utilized, this glucose is accumulating in the body, and it's being stored under the lining of the blood vessels. The blood vessels get tight, they get more narrow, and we call that high blood pressure. So essentially, then if the causes are similar, then the good news is that the way to fix it for all of these diseases is very similar. In other words, the lifestyle for heart disease reversal, it would be very similar to the lifestyle that you need to follow to not get Alzheimer's, and it's the same lifestyle that you need to follow to not get diabetes.
Why does it show up in different places for different people? Is it just the matter of gene expression and different individuals and having different types of genes?
Yes, gene expression has a lot to do with it. And we have certain genetic predispositions, right? But we should also keep in mind that your DNA is not your destiny, right? So genes could be like a loaded gun, right? So I could walk around with a loaded gun in my pocket every day for my entire life, but it's the environment that pulls the trigger. So the harm is only going to be done when I, for whatever reason, decide to pull that gun out and I pull the trigger, and that's when somebody's going to get hurt. But genes just means that I have the propensity, the potential to have some, create some damage. But it doesn't mean that it's a guarantee that the damage is going to be done just because I have a loaded gun. The damage is going to be done when that trigger gets pulled. So yes, someone might have more of a propensity for diabetes versus someone else who has a lot of heart disease in their family versus someone else who has prostate cancer versus someone else who has Alzheimer's. So our predispositions could vary, but the environmental factors, the external factors, the epigenetic factors that will cause those diseases to manifest are still quite similar.
I know you've talked about, or you mentioned that it's incredibly effective for preventing a lot of diseases and basically keeping your metabolism sharp is probably one of the best ways of staying healthy. But in terms of reversing disease, if you already have one of these, like say Alzheimer's or diabetes or some of these other ones, how effective is it in reversing a chronic condition, a chronic disease, and how long might that take?
So there's a lot of research for cardiovascular disease, and in fact, as early as 1989, it was shown that you could reverse blockages in the heart with lifestyle. And it was shown with diet in combination with exercise, meditation, and group therapy. So a prolonged period of time where people eat largely whole foods, plant-based diet, where there's some structured exercise, where they're learning stress management techniques, sleep hygiene. It was documented that you could actually open up blocked arteries. Dr. Dean Ornish from UCSF was the first one to show that. Those results have been replicated by many, and very prominent voices are now joining that movement. People like Bill Clinton became plant-based. He actually became vegan, even though he was known for his love of cheeseburgers. When he was president, he would send his Secret Service guys to go get him cheeseburgers from, McDonald's. But after he had his heart attack, he actually became vegan. And as far as we know, he hasn't had another episode since then. I couldn't say if he's reversed his disease, but at least he's halted it and it hasn't progressed forward. There's many, many examples like that. With type 2 diabetes, it certainly, if it's caught early enough, now this might not be someone who's been diabetic for 20 years, but if you've had type 2 diabetes that was fairly recent, I would say in the last 5, even 10 years, you can, to a very large extent, reverse most of the effects of the type 2 diabetes. None of the medicines does this, right? None of the medicines, prescription medicines, will actually change the course of the disease. They might manage the disease, right? And the whole thinking is, okay, this is a disease management strategy, but it doesn't reverse the disease. With Alzheimer's, it's a little bit more tricky. I think depending on the degree, if someone already has advanced Alzheimer's and grandma doesn't know, her kids' names or where she lives or what year it is, I would be exaggerating if I said that, you read my Turbo Metabolism book to her and she's going to, everything's going to come back. But I think if it's early on, where we have something called mild cognitive impairment, where, a lot of us in our 50s and 60s start to experience a little bit of, I forgot where I parked the car, can't find my keys, right? Or forgot if I paid this bill or not. So it's mild changes. Certainly we can slow down the progression and halt it, and in some cases even reverse it by optimizing the lifestyle choices that this person's making.
Yeah, we had Dale Bredesen on the show a while back, who I'm sure you're familiar with. And
yes, of course.
Essentially, his approach to reversing MCI in early stage Alzheimer's and even late stage Alzheimer's in some degree is very similar. I mean, going over the notes I have here on your book and some of the techniques we're going to talk about in a minute, the approach is very similar. Like, he has some specifics and different protocols, but overall, it appears that there's a lot of overlap in both of them. And I think it's very applicable to the philosophy you have and the philosophy that many functional, you know, naturopathic or doctors like you who are beyond just the regular prescription medication and some of the poor doctors out there who only spend those 10 minutes and just want to get you out of there, as opposed to the people who want to actually do the real work and kind of dive into that. It's very similar. The protocol, I think, is there's a lot of overlap there. And I think there's a lot to be said about what you're talking about here and optimizing your metabolism first and then reaping the benefits of a healthier life afterwards.
There's a lot of research going on this stuff, and not only from the disease condition standpoint, but also looking at human longevity and optimization, right? How do I optimize my body so that I can have the best quality of life that I can have? And, you know, more quantity of life would be nice too, but you know, I certainly don't want to be living to 140 in a rocking chair in a nursing home somewhere. But if I can live to 107 and still be driving and you know, going hiking and backpacking and having sex, you know, I'll take that. So yeah. So let's look, you know, think about health span, not just lifespan. And there's so much research going on this topic. And I think with all the other advances in technology that we have with internet and smartphones and now self-driving cars and, you know, airplanes that can fly themselves across the Atlantic Ocean, you know, it only makes sense that we should be doing whatever we can to optimize the functioning of our own bodies too, because you only get one body.
Is there any types of conditions that this turbo metabolism won't help or won't improve significantly? For instance, we mentioned type 2 diabetes, and that's one of the ones you can improve on and even reverse in some cases. What about type 1 diabetes, where it's genetic, and some of those diseases of that nature?
Well, first of all, type 1 diabetes is less than 10% of all diabetes. So 90% of diabetes now is type 2. So, you know, if you rounded up 10 diabetics, 9 of them are going to be type 2s. So this does apply to all of those type 2s for sure. Even for a type 1, I think optimizing their diet, getting them sleeping, managing stress, getting them exercising, having them with the right social support networks and everything can make a big difference. Will it reverse it? Probably not. But will it improve the quality of their life, their lifespan, their health span, their overall sense of well-being? Absolutely. And that's sort of what I was trying to communicate earlier too, that turbo metabolism is not about not having a disease, right? Health is not the absence of disease. Health is about being at your optimal level of functioning physically, mentally, psychologically, and I would add spiritually if someone has any inclination in that realm. So it's really about being healthy and strong is a sense of well-being and optimal functioning in all of those realms. It's not just, okay, I don't have any diagnosed diseases, I don't take any prescriptions, so I must be healthy. No, it's more than that. That's acceptable, but optimal is something more than that.
Doctor, so let's go through some of these steps here. What are the I think there's six, right? Six major steps in the book. Can you just kind of quickly run through those, and then maybe we'll dive into some specifics on a couple of them?
Yeah, so it's in essence, right, it's about how we eat, sleep, and move, right? And I think you're referring to my six master levers of health, which we talked about, which are what we do with our feet, forks, and fingers, right? We move with our feet, we eat with our forks, we might choose to smoke or take in other toxins with our fingers, like drinking alcohol, or I would put dairy right in there too with toxins. So feet, forks, and fingers, and then sleep, stress, and love. Or if you want to have it all three S's to make it easy to remember, we can say sleep, stress, and social connections. So people that know how to manage stress well, people that have good sleep hygiene, people that are well supported by their peers, have a good, strong, healthy social network. And this is across societies. This is all over the world. This research is from looking at longevity. And the longest lived populations in the world live in close-knit social communities. They have that as a way to manage stress. They can stay in sync with their sleep-wake cycles. And they eat mostly a whole foods plant-based diet or a nutrient-dense plant-rich diet. They move, they walk from place to place, they ride their bicycles, they swim. They don't rely on automated, mechanized transportation. And for the most part, they don't really smoke or drink that much.
That's where you came up with these six steps, just studying some of these other cultures?
Yeah, and really think about it. It's common sense too, right? It's like what happens to your health or my health is going to be to a huge extent dependent on how we eat, sleep, and move, who we hang out with, right? And in general, how we feel about ourselves. Are we feeling stressed and overwhelmed? Are we feeling like we have a good sense of control and mastery over our environment? And that makes all the difference in the world.
For the forks step, how many times a day do you recommend people eat, and what are some of the main foods that they're eating?
You know, this has changed so much. And as I researched this book, I realized that what I had been telling people for the last 20 years was wrong.
Really?
Right. So I had been telling people that you have to eat three meals and two or three snacks. You should be eating six times a day. That's how you keep the metabolism revved up. And that at some level, that wasn't really jiving with what I thought I knew from the history, you know, of just human history. And we know that over civilizations across cultures, people have fasted for periods of time. And you think about, you know, our ancestors who were maybe roaming around in search of food from place to place weren't getting, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner and two snacks. They were eating when they could. And it turns out that our body's actually built that way. It's built to work a lot better when we're cycling between sort of feast and famine, right? So actually having longer periods of time between feedings and being in the non-fed state for longer periods of time appears to be much more beneficial than the six, you know, six feedings. So, you know, maybe one or two meals, but shrinking them to a shorter window of the day. So if you wake up at 8, maybe eating something around the time that you wake up, and then another meal or even three meals, but get it all done by about 4 p.m. So then you're in the non-fed state for the remainder of the 24 hours. So from 4 p.m. until 8 a.m. So less frequent meals that are compressed to a shorter feeding window as far as the meal timing part. As far as the meal composition, again, looking across cultures, across the globe, and down the time spectrum, the longest-lived populations generally eat a diet that is very rich in plants, and it's a nutrient-dense, plant-rich diet. And so plants are higher in nutrients, they're not very high in calories. So by default, you're getting a calorie reduction too, even without having to count calories or cut portions. So you're eating a calorie-sparse, nutrient-dense, plant-rich diet, and that's going to be a diet of unprocessed food. That's going to be a diet that doesn't have a lot of junk food and packaged food in it. So we were eating foods that are essentially closer to the ground.
So it seems like we're recommending an overnight 16-hour fast. Does that, when you do that, does that put you into ketosis where you're burning fat stores on your body overnight, and that's one of the healthier aspects of this?
That would be one way to, yes. So when you're at the end of that fast, you are in fat burn. On the other hand, if you keep stuffing things in your mouth all the way until you close your eyes at night, right, you're not really, you don't get to burn fat at all. Because what happens when you eat, your insulin level goes up. Insulin is produced by the pancreas to capture that energy from the bloodstream and store it. And every time we eat, the insulin goes up. So the only way that we can allow the insulin to go down is by not eating. So when we don't eat, that's when insulin goes down and your body is able to go into what we call lipolysis or fat burn. And the real way to get the prehistoric man would go into ketogenesis by default because they would be running around from place to place in search of food. And so that your muscles don't waste away, your body switches into using ketone bodies for fuel at about the third day of a fast. On the third day of a fast, your body switches over to using ketone bodies, which are a breakdown product of fat. So you go into fat burn after a period of being in the non-fed state. And while I recognize that that's hard to do, to not eat for three, four, 5 days, for those of us that are, you know, trying to manage everything else in this modern world, I think it's pretty easy to do the 8-hour eating, 16-hour fast. Everybody can do that.
So you're saying you don't actually go into ketosis until after 3 days, or are you temporarily entering into ketosis for a couple of hours towards the end of that 16-hour fast?
You are, to a very slight extent, mm-hmm. slight extent. But on a real fast where you're only having water, you would on the third day be primarily burning ketone bodies, which would come from the burning of fat. I mean, all of us can go 20 to 30 days without food, just water. We couldn't go without water, but we can definitely go without food for about 30 days. The longest that someone has gone without food is over a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. That is insane.
Well, he was also 400 plus pounds, so at the end of this year-long fast, he had lost a couple hundred pounds.
Oh,
so
wow. That actually makes sense, yeah.
Because the body...
These fat stores, yes, for energy.
Absolutely. And so this just leads, and I might be digressing a little bit, but you know, the idea of someone who is, say, 100 pounds overweight and they're walking into Burger King because they feel like they're hungry and they're buying a Whopper and fries, there's something wrong with their metabolism, right? Because their body shouldn't be giving them the signal that they need a Whopper right now. If they already have 100 pounds extra, they've got plenty of Whoppers stored in their body. So something is wrong with that signaling system in mm-hmm. impaired metabolism, where you're getting the signal that you should be eating a Whopper when you already have enough stores inside you.
So is it safe to or recommended to switch between your sources of energy, like switching from glucose to ketone bodies as your fuel? Is that recommended to jump back and forth between that, or is it better to sort of stay in one area as opposed to the other?
Well, that's the amazing, miraculous machine that we have here, right? It's designed to do that all the time. It is designed to, like I said, be shifting between feast and famine, right? And in a fed state, we would be using as the substrate, as the fuel, this food that was taken in, which would be converted to glucose, and then that glucose would be used as essentially the energy currency in the body. And in the non-fed state, seamlessly, the body is designed to switch into using fat. Much like, say, some of these hybrid cars, right? When you're going up a hill and you're trying to pick up speed, or you're trying to merge on the freeway, it's burning gas. And then when you're going down a hill or you're coasting, you take your foot off the gas pedal and it automatically switches into battery power, right? So it's designed to do that seamlessly, and you don't hurt it by making it do that. That's what it's made for.
So essentially, yeah, it is a good idea to use both sources, and not just, like most people think, you know, glucose, carbs, that's, you know, my fuel source, and that's pretty much what they'll rely on. And hence where I think the whole idea of the zone diet and eating 5 to 6 meals a day and keeping your blood sugar regulated, I think there's something to that. But I also think it sort of goes overboard with, like you said, too, and a lot of other people and you know, really smart scientists and researchers are coming out with now, that keeping your glucose elevated throughout the day by eating many meals, even if it's smaller meals, probably isn't the healthiest way. But I think that's where that belief came from, right?
Yeah, it's a whole idea of like carb loading, right? So you're carb loading before a marathon, and you're essentially saturating the sugar stores of the muscles. And if you do that, that's fine. You won't bonk, and you'll be able to complete that run. And they're giving you bananas along the way on the marathon or the half marathon, whatever you're running. But you're also not going into fat burn. Right. So if you're at a weight where you want to stay and you don't have a lot of extra body fat that you want to get rid of, then that's fine. You know, you can eat the 5 meals and keep the sugar level constant and maintain everything in the status quo. But if you're looking to have 6-pack abs and you're looking to go from 20% fat to 9% body fat, then you're going to need to figure out a way to actually put the body into fat burn. And the way that it's going to happen is by forcing it to use that stored fat as fuel. And you know, the body's really smart. Or you could say that it's lazy, But, you know, being lazy is kind of a way of being smart, because why would you want to do any more work than you have to, right? I think lazy people are really smart, because they've figured out to get things done with the least amount of work. And over our evolution, you know, our bodies have, our system has become really smart / lazy, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, if you want to make it do something different than what it's sort of doing by default, then you have to think about how you can hack it a little bit.
What are your thoughts on the ketogenic diet specifically versus a plant-based diet where you're eating, say, 60 to 70% of your macronutrients from carbs, well, healthy carbs, plants and veggies and things of that nature? Why recommend plant versus just going right into keto and staying in there? I know the benefits of ketogenic diets and being in ketosis are coming out, and they're proving to be very effective.
Well, again, the what we get from our food is much more than just calories, right? Do we agree on that? That we get energy and information. We get energy and information from our food. Plants have phytonutrients, they have antioxidants, they have vitamins and minerals, they have disease-fighting, immune-boosting wisdom that has been given to those plants. Over time, they have evolved to have that plant, to have all that stuff that comes from the soil, from the earth, from the sun, from the water. And animals work synergistically with these plants, and by eating those plants, we take in some of that goodness of those plants, which helps us stay healthy and fight disease. And in exchange, we digest those plants, and then we go from one place to another, and we poop out the seeds, and so this plant gets to reproduce and spread its progeny to different places from the animals that are pooping out its seeds. When we eat animals, well, first of all, all the nutrients in the animals too did come from eating plants, but it's a very inefficient way of concentrating energy. So your animal diet is going to have a lot more calories, it's going to have a lot more saturated fat, but it's not going to have any of those disease-fighting ingredients that plants do. So if there's a way to eat a diet that puts you into ketosis that is largely plant-based, I would be okay with that if the research supported it. I think, but there's absolutely no studies. Show me one population anywhere in the world that eats an animal-based, high-fat, high-saturated fat, quote-unquote ketogenic diet that has any longevity. Is there any population in the world that anybody can name?
I don't know. Did the Eskimos have that type of diet or no?
The Eskimos, so the Inuit Indians were eating whale blubber and stuff like that. People from the North Pole, and the Inuit Indians are known to have cardiovascular disease and heart attacks in their 40s. So there's no longevity in that group, absolutely. Wow. But to your point, I mean, to a large extent too, diets would have evolved based on location. Right, where people lived. So if you lived on a coast and you have access to coconuts, then you're eating coconuts. If you lived in Finland, then you're not eating, you know, coconut oil shouldn't be a part of your diet, because your ancestors really wouldn't even recognize that as food. So I mean, not to be dogmatic about this, I would say that in the type of food that is ideal would be dependent on genetics, on geographic location, on activity level, on age, on what stage of life you're in, right? All those things could change over time. But speaking very generally, a nutrient-dense, plant-rich diet across the board, you know, there's no controversy. Even if you're talking to, you know, the ketogenic folks, the paleo folks, the Mediterraneans, the vegans, the zone diet, and there's nobody's arguing that eating plant strong is, you know, going to lead you in the wrong direction. Nobody can argue with that.
Yeah, I think you're right about that for sure. In terms of athletic performance, in terms of muscle building, for a lot of guys listening to the show, muscles are typically a big aspect of what they want anyways. The guys want to have big muscles. They want to be stronger. They want to be bigger. They want to have more strength. When you have this type of diet where you're eating mostly veggies, plant-based foods, protein goes down for sure. The ability to, I think, build muscle can be affected. How do you stay clear of that and maintain your muscle or even increase muscle building through having a diet like this?
Actually, that's not what you said is not entirely true, that protein goes down. So plants are pretty high in protein, and you can get all your essential amino acids from plants. If you're eating a good mix of plants, if you're eating all the different colors, if you're getting beans, if you're eating spirulina, if you're getting your nuts and seeds, you're going to get the amount of protein that you need. And there are plenty of NFL folks, people in the NBA, in mixed martial arts, wherever you look, there's lots and lots of plant-based athletes that are popping up everywhere, triathletes. And one thing that they all say in common is that you recover a lot faster when you're eating a plant-based diet, again, because of those antioxidants, those phytonutrients, those disease-fighting, inflammation-reducing chemicals that are in those plants, you recover a lot faster from injuries. You have less pain after a game. If you get hurt, you're going to get better a lot faster. The inflammation is a lot lower. The swelling is a lot less. And you're actually going to, therefore, perform better because you can train harder when you're eating plant-based. The other part was I say was, you know, guys also care about sexual performance, and if you look at your coronary arteries, they're the same width as the artery that takes blood to your penis. It's about 3 millimeters, right? 3 millimeters is a very, very tiny straw, and it doesn't take a lot for that to get blocked. So if you're eating a whole bunch of bacon and sausage and, you know, hamburgers with cheese and mayonnaise and French fries, thinking that you're getting all this protein, you also, from that animal food, and the flesh of that animal rich in all those saturated fats, you're also going to block those arteries. So do keep in mind that part too, that in a lot of, you know, we see all these ads for Viagra and Cialis and Levitra with the people in, sitting in the bathtubs, which I don't understand that what that ad is all about. So erectile dysfunction is often a precursor of heart disease. So in other words, wow. So someone that has erectile dysfunction is that's the canary in the coal mine, and they're telling you that, hey, I'm going to have a heart attack in the next 10, 15 years if I have erectile dysfunction already. So that's the other thing to keep in mind. And we can go on and on about IGF-1 and how, you know, animal foods will increase your insulin-like growth factor, which is something that would be good if you were, you know, 16 years old and you want to bulk up. But if you're a 50-year-old guy and you're eating the same foods that you were eating when you were 16 with lots of, you know, meat and eggs and dairy and have really high levels of IGF-1, I don't know how much muscle growth you're going to get, but you're definitely going to promote the growth of prostate cancer and lung cancer and colon cancer too, because again, it's insulin-like growth factor, so it'll help things grow. So it's if it's muscle that you're trying to grow when you're 16, yes, that's fine. But now I'm 49, I'm 50 years old, I already have some microscopic areas of cancer in my body already there. If I increase my IGF-1, you know, I'm going to essentially put some fuel on the fire of that cancer too.
Wow, that's very interesting. Last question in terms of the forks part. I want to cover maybe one other part. I know we're sort of coming up on time here, but I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation. But what are your thoughts on whole wheat? Does that have a place in this plant-based diet?
So there's a lot of controversy about grains in
whole
general,
grains, yeah,
right? So you're talking about grains in general, and I would say this, that if it's true unprocessed grain would be whole kernel grains, right? But when we make wheat, we are already pulverizing that grain into a fine powder, which is then processed into make, you know, your favorite bread or roti or naan or whatever you're eating. That's a processed that's a processed plant now. It's not a whole plant. And when I said whole foods plant-based diet, I was talking about unprocessed plants. So, and that applies to grains too, that we want to truly have a whole grain would be a whole kernel grain. So I think a short way to just to sort of think about that is let's prioritize greens over grains, right? More greens, less grains. And if you want to get some of that healthy unprocessed carbohydrates that is more starchy, you can get it from things like sweet potatoes and baked potatoes and things like that, rather than eating a whole bunch of bread, which is, again, processed grain. It's not truly whole kernel unprocessed grain. And then there's all the stuff about gluten and everything, which maybe we can get into another time.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode on that stuff.
Absolutely.
So we have the forks, the feet, which is basically exercising and activity, keeping yourself moving. Fingers, watching, you know, quitting smoking, watching what you put into your body, toxins, poisons, etc. Sleep, which I think everybody knows is incredibly important. And I just had a doctor on a couple episodes. We kind of dove into that pretty well. Stress management, and then social connections. The final three S's: sleep, stress, social connections, and then the first three F's, I guess you can look at it that way, social connections and love. Of those other steps, is there one we can kind of dive into, you know, for a minute or two? I just want to touch on at least one of these.
Well, we could talk about stress. I think that's the chapter that I had the most fun writing in the book. And cool. I think, you know, we're sort of living in this epidemic of stress. Everybody's stressed out, and a lot of times stress leads to unhealthy decisions, right? We make unhealthy lifestyle choices. Oh, why did you, you know, start smoking again? I had a stressful time. I had a tough relationship. I lost my job. And, you know, frankly, we're, you know, sort of swimming in this ocean of stress all the time. We're, you know, chronically overwhelmed. We are constantly connected, right, through these devices to our work. And if we're not looking at our work, we're on social media, we're comparing ourselves to other people, we're looking at, you know, how Justin is always on vacation in Italy or Hawaii, and I'm sitting here working away. And that's, you know, so there's all these unnatural stressors that we are dealing with, which we haven't really evolved to deal with, right? The stress response is a focused fight or flight response of increase in blood pressure, pulse rate, pupils dilating, we're sweating. It's because you were being faced by a danger. A grizzly bear just showed up and you need to get the hell out of here. That's what that stress response is designed for. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have those physical dangers anymore. We have these psychosocial stressors, the job, the spouse, the friends, the teenage kids, the mortgage, the taxes, which aren't really life-threatening, but they're constant and they're just gnawing away at us. And that's not what we're designed to cope with. So figuring out a stress management or a stress mitigation strategy is about developing some controls, having some predictability, having some outlets for it, whether it's exercise or social outlets or music, right? Having optimism is a stress reliever. And then we talk about some specific techniques in the book, different ways of, you know, meditation techniques, whether it's concentration meditation, mindfulness or expressive meditation, participation in some sort of spiritual process, if that works for you. There's a lot of different things that we can do to decrease the brunt of that stress. We can't change the environment, but we can change our response by reframing the picture.
Cool. Love it. Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the big themes of this show as well, is decreasing your stress through whatever that is, meditation, exercise, music, healthy habits, listening to shows like this, hopefully.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you do a great job.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. So wrapping things up, Dr. Veej, is there a final send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience, and then also a place that our listeners can check out your latest book and the website?
Well, the message would be, you know, love yourself. There's nothing more manly than, you know, self-compassion, because if you can love yourself, you can love others better. And so really take care of this amazing, miraculous, magical machine that you've been given, right? It's more precious than the most expensive car that you can ever dream of, So take good care of it. Love yourself so that you can love better. You can find me at drvij.com, drvij.com. And like you said, the book is Turbo Metabolism, 8 Weeks to a New You. And I'm really happy with how it's doing really well on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and probably at your local bookstore too. And yeah, check it out.
Awesome, guys. Make sure you check that out again, Turbo Metabolism. We run down all these steps that we talked about in today's episode and, of course, dive into some of the ones we didn't get to touch on specifically. It's a really cool book. I look forward to running through it myself. Dr. Vij, thanks so much again for coming on. I really do appreciate your time and for sharing your wisdom with our audience. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
It's been a pleasure. You take care as well. Cheers.
Packed with 28 powerful nutrients, our Elite Life Nutrition's Men's Multivitamin is the perfect daily supplement to guarantee you're at your best every single day. As men, we have to do a million things, and oftentimes we overlook eating 100% optimally. But that's just the beginning. From work to sleep to gym to home life and more, oftentimes the stress can add up and start to take a toll on our bodies and our health. When it does, we see a significant drop off in energy, mood, stamina, strength, immune function, and yes, even performance in the bedroom. That's why it's so critical to ensure we're covering all the bases in terms of essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients. And that's why you should really consider taking a powerful and effective and completely safe multivitamin supplement like our brand new Men's Multivitamin. Not only do we give you the critical amounts of vitamins and minerals, including powerful antioxidants like vitamins A, C, E, and selenium, and all of the B-complex vitamins, including niacin, B12, and folate, and extremely important minerals like magnesium, calcium, chromium, and zinc, but we also add in a Men's Vegetable and Fruit Blend to top off this nutritional boon. And all the forms of these nutrients are the best that money can buy. We leave no stone unturned. We give you the most absorbable and effective forms of these vitamins and minerals. Unlike so many other supplement companies out there that just go for the cheap synthetic stuff, our daily multivitamin comes with the perfect potencies from the ideal sources to make sure you actually reap the benefits of what you're taking in from a multivitamin supplement. After all, as a man, you deserve to be at your best. Go to elitelifenutrition.com/multi, that's M-U-L-T-I, to order our Men's Multivitamin supplement right now. Again, that's elitelifenutrition.com/multi. I guarantee you're going to love this daily multivitamin.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.